The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, a very, very good morning to you. How are you?
Boker tov, shavua tov. More rain in Israel over the weekend, a bit of snow on the Hermon. So winter certainly reaching us with a vengeance. Temperatures are certainly down. I think November is one of the wettest Novembers that we have had on record ever.
Incredible.
In the state of Israel. Lots and lots of rain in November. Of course, it has come at a cost, some flooding, some damage done. Fortunately, there have been no injuries to speak of that I'm aware of. People had to be rescued. Children were rescued from a kindergarten in one downpour. But the thing that surprises me is just how the rain comes down. When it rains, it really doesn't muck about.
Yeah,
really
Israel's got incredibly – I always say, I think the drops are bigger in Israel. Because somehow you definitely get more wet there than anywhere else.
It's just crazy when it really starts to rain. Mm. Thunder and lightning. We had some thunderstorms over the weekend, quite some serious rain. And then just as quickly as it comes down, it like dries up. And, you know, within an hour, you wouldn't even know that there was any rain. I mean, there have been some quite somewhat amusing videos circulated of flooding that carried on in the streets of Israel during the previous downpour. I say slightly amusing because the Israeli drainage system cannot cope with the volume of water that comes down during these rainfalls. And the joke is that for 6 months of the year, these drainage systems are out of work. They don't get used at all. Then all of a sudden, when the rain comes, they can't cope with the volume of water, and inevitably there's flooding and the streets are washed, water washing up everywhere. And there is a real dilemma about how much money should be invested in water drainage systems when for 6 months of the year and probably more, they're hardly get used. But when that moment comes that the heavens open, they really are needed because within a very short space of time, the streets become severely flooded.
Yeah, absolutely crazy. Prime Minister Netanyahu yesterday warned that Israel is entering its third wave of the coronavirus.
Yeah, some people haven't even got to the second wave yet, right? For some reason, things are very accelerated in Israel. No messing around. We've been through the second wave. We're already on the verge of a third wave. And it's leaving people a little confused and I guess somewhat angry as well because there seems to be little common view about how all of this should be handled. And I find this a little surprising, seeing as we kind of have so much experience now. We've been through two waves. We should know what's going on. And yet there is still a lack of consensus about exactly what should be done. The stark facts are that apparently there were 870 cases of coronavirus that were diagnosed out of 21,388 tests, which means that 4% of all tests that were conducted actually came back positive. We have had days in the last week or so where more than 1,000 new cases have been diagnosed every day. At the moment, they say that we've got something like 550 patients who are hospitalized, 239 of them are in serious condition, 85 on ventilators, and all in all, 2,915 Israelis have passed away due to COVID. So those are kind of the statistics. I know we didn't have Dr. Myberg today, so I guess it's my turn to talk numbers. I think the main thing is, what do we do next? I mean, yesterday, the last two classes of school who had not yet returned to frontal learning, yesterday actually returned to classes. So at the moment, according to government guidelines, all children are now back at school, physically back at school rather than electronically back at school. Not all of them have got a full week. Some of them are still doing class sharing, one day on, one day off, one day in, one day remotely. I've noticed a lot of classes taking place outside in parks as you drive around. A lot of groups are gathered outdoors in order to somehow take advantage of some of the good weather that we're having, despite the fact that it's winter and has been raining a lot, but to try and get their children out and about. The mall experiment continues. In other words, those malls that were allowed to reopen just a little bit more than a week ago have continued to operate under the strict guidelines that have been laid down. But that extension, that allowance of operating the malls is only extended until today. There was a meeting yesterday of the coronavirus cabinet. No decisions were taken. They're due to reconvene again this evening. And there is an expectation that we could well go into another kind of a lockdown. But of course, most of the discussion surrounds vaccines and what's happening on the vaccine front. And a lot of talk about vaccines, some of which is very, very difficult to believe. But if one does believe what people are saying in public, then Israeli vaccination programs will begin within the next 3 to 4 weeks. And there are some people who are suggesting that by the end of January, we could already have vaccinated 20% of the population, which I think is an astonishing statistic. And if we get anything close to that, then I will be super impressed. But the truth of the matter is that vaccines are now on their way here in quite large numbers. I understand that we will be getting something like 4 million vaccines from Pfizer, which really allows for the vaccination of 2 million people because each person needs 2 injections out of that, and something like 6 million Moderna vaccinations, which are 1 per person. So that's another 6 million people who could potentially be vaccinated. So if we take 6 and 2, that's 8 million out of a total population of approximately 10 million. Those vaccinations could cover 80% of the population. And there's a very clear list of priorities that has been laid down as to who will be vaccinated and when. First of all, frontline health workers. Second of all, elderly people and high-risk people in high-risk categories. Thereafter, we get into people who are serving the general public. Finally, at the end, of course, everybody else. So there is a lot of talk about vaccinations. Until they actually begin rolling out the program of vaccinating people. I mean, if they want to adhere to those targets that were issued, they're going to have to be vaccinating something like 100,000 people a day. They have only been testing something like 20,000 or 30,000 a day. So it's difficult for me to see how they're going to be getting 100,000 people through the door every day to vaccinate them. But, you know, the Israeli public in general and the professionals in particular like a little bit of a challenge. And so we can't rule anything out. But we've heard in the last day or two that the Russian government has begun vaccinating people in Moscow with the Sputnik vaccination. And they were talking about vaccinating something like 5,000 to 10,000 people a day in Moscow. So it seems as if though we're now moving into the phase of large volume vaccinations. It'll be interesting to see how that pans out here.
Yeah, so at least it is moving forward. We have our own issues here, but unfortunately nowhere near getting the vaccine here. Unofficial reports suggest that Iran's supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khamenei, has handed his powers to his son due to his ill health. How significant is this change of leadership?
I think it is significant because I think that a lot of what has been happening in Iran, particularly this anti-Western, anti-Israeli feeling, comes at least to some degree from the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. He is 81 years old. He apparently has suffered in the past from prostate cancer, and there are suggestions that he might have had a relapse and that his health is not good enough for him to continue in his role, and that he's handed over to his 51-year-old son, who has been overseeing several important security and intelligence departments already. There are many questions about this whole situation. First of all, whether it's really happened. We don't have a firm confirmation of the fact that this has really actually gone on. Second of all, whether this is even constitutionally allowed in Iran, because and there are people who have suggested this is against the constitution, and the way for the power transfer to take place is via a vote of the Supreme Council. And we understand that that is yet to happen. So whether this transfer to his son can actually stand is also a question. There are lots of conflicting parties within Iran, particularly the revolutionary guards, who seem to have quite a big say in who might be the next supreme leader, big vote in all of that. So all of this is very, very unclear, and it just adds a lot to the uncertainty, the instability that we see around Iran. And, you know, people are silently celebrating that Iran is suffering all of these things. I'm not sure that it's such a good thing that they go through such instability, although a change would not go amiss as far as Israel and the West is concerned, because a change of view would be a good thing. But I'm not sure that the son of the Ayatollah Khamenei will change anything, because he's been so entrenched in the regime up until now, leading those departments and those activities as he has done on behalf of his father, that I don't think that this necessarily represents a big change. But until such time as things have sort of stabilized and we can get a feel as to who's really in charge and what their view is, I think that there's this, this level of uncertainty, and it's not clear how that might play out. Where we know that Iran are on this revenge right now against the assassination of the nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, and we also know that, you know, attacks might come from Hezbollah and from Hamas and from other Iranian Iranian-sponsored militia. So all in all, uncertainty at the moment is not a terribly good thing.
Absolutely. This story to me was really, really, I mean, I know it's not funny, but when I saw some of the transcripts, I thought that it really was. An Israeli insurance company was the victim of a severe ransomware attack. Tell us about this incident. And I have to say that when I saw the transcripts of the negotiations between the Israelis and the hackers, I thought, wow, you don't get more Israel than this.
This is this truly crazy story, because first of all, obviously, hackers around the world would love to show up Israeli, the Israeli economy and Israeli companies in the cyber field, given Israel's strong showing and massive numbers of cyber tools that have been developed in Israel, that there's nothing that would give a hacker more pleasure than getting involved in a situation like this, as they have done with the Shirbit insurance company, where the Black Shadow Group has managed to find some sort of a cyber hole in their security system and has got hold of a whole vast array of documents, screenshots, documents, ID cards, marriage certificates, financial documents of people who are insured with Shirbit. And they've made some of this information public. Now, whereas usual ransomware attacks are all about the money, give us the money and we'll give you your data back, this does not seem to be the case at all. Black Shadow have demanded 50 Bitcoin, which I think is worth almost $1 million.
Oh, wow.
If my... I mean, 50 Bitcoin these days is quite a lot of money. The insurance company has decided that they're not going to pay over the money to Black Shadow. Usually what happens is they grab hold of your data. They make sure that you have no access to your data. They say, give me your money. And then when the money is received, they either give you your data back, or in some cases don't give you your data back, take the money and the data and run with it anyway. In the case of Shirbit, they do have their data, so they are continuing to operate, but they have been severely embarrassed by the publication of many private documents belonging to people who are insured with them. And this joke, as you mentioned, Howard, about the negotiations, because they've made all of that public, and there's actually even apparently a Telegram channel which has got some of the messages going backwards and forwards between the negotiators and the Black Shadow hackers. This is really, I mean, this is just out of a movie almost. You couldn't imagine that such a situation could persist, but the insurance company seems to be very determined in their view that they're not going to pay up the money, they're not going to give in to the threats. I know that the National Cybersecurity Organization, which is a government organization, has also been involved in this to see what can be done to somehow save embarrassment and to save information. But this is a pretty serious breach. And I'm not sure that it was necessarily targeted to Shirbit. I think that they might have just been trawling around the web somewhere and found a hole in one of these organizations and decided to go in. The problem, of course, is that once all this information has been made public or has at least been taken by the hackers, one doesn't know where it lands up on the dark web. So even if they might say, well, we've got our money, we're going to go quiet, we're not going to make things public. But a lot of this stuff does circulate below the surface and circulates around the dark web, and it never really goes away. So this is a pretty serious story, and it's not over yet. It's been almost like a kidnap drama. If you don't give us the money by a certain hour, then we're going to release these kind of documents. And, you know, we've had a few of these deadlines pass where no money has been paid out and this information has been released. I think a lot of people who are insured with the company have lost their trust in this company due to this ridiculous situation that's been persisting. It really is quite ridiculous. First of all, there is going to be some sort of an investigation as to how the security was poor enough to allow such a hack to go on. But also the way that it's been managed, to me, at least seems ridiculous, and it sounds like that they've been entertaining you as well, Howard.
I found it really, really funny. As I say, the most Israeli thing I've ever seen is negotiating the price, and the guy says it's like dating, we've got to get to know each other, let's have a bit of a conversation. I thought it was an absolute delight. But then,
classic negotiations, right? It reminds you of these kidnap situations where
yes,
you see them
exactly.
You know, trying to gain the trust of the kidnappers
100%.
Before we send the hit squad in to rescue the people who've been kidnapped or whatever it is. It's a little bit like that.
It is indeed. It is 8 o'clock. Anthony Rach, thank you as always. We'll catch you tomorrow morning, same time, same place.